Thanks, Billy. My name's Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Billy, for having me come down. I've been here a couple other times before to hear my sponsor and a couple of friends speak, and I've always enjoyed being here and coming down and seeing you guys. It's certainly a great drive. And it's just a peaceful drive coming down here. Nice break from sitting in traffic in D.C. all the time. Anyway, my sobriety date's January 15th of 2002. The Midtown group is my home group. We meet Sunday nights back home. And, my story is nothing that you guys haven't heard before. You know, I grew up in Maryland, in Montgomery County, just outside D.C., and, grew up in a very loving home. Parents were, they were there, and, you know, they got divorced when I was 13, and that's like the real first memory that I can, that I have. I mean, people talk about feeling different from the beginning. Oh, I never felt right from the very start. I don't remember. I just don't remember. So I guess I didn't feel all that different. You know, but what I do remember, I mean, I remember my parents got divorced, all my friends, everybody's parents were getting divorced at the time. So it wasn't, like, strange, it didn't make, like, my family, like, different or anything like that. It was just what everybody was doing. And, but what it did is the way I saw it is that my dad left, and that is something that would be, you know, pretty big. It would be a huge resentment, although I didn't know that that's what it was. I just figured he left, and you know, I just didn't like him and left me to be the man of the house. I mean, however much you can be the man of the house at 13, you know. It's not like I was like the breadwinner or anything. I just would just go to school and come home and make a steak. And but I got drunk for the first time when I was 16. Had always had this fascination with alcohol. What I do remember before being 13 is flipping through like Rolling Stone and seeing the liquor ads in there and just thinking, wow, these people have like marketing geniuses, you know? I mean, look at this ad. It's so much better than like the cigarette ad or the Pepsi ad or anything like that. It's just, the liquor ads just stood out, you know? They had the hotter women, the better looking product, you know? The bottles looked so good versus like the pack of Cools on the next page. I was always kind of fascinated by it. I don't know if I was like attracted to it or not. I mean, I hadn't even gotten drunk at that point yet. The first time I got drunk, I was 16, and it's, I did it to impress a girl. We were at a house party, and walking into the house party, I thought, I'm going to get as drunk as I possibly can tonight, and I don't care what happens. And because I knew the guys that she hung out with their white hats and everything and their collared shirts, I knew that they drank a lot, and she liked hanging out with those guys. And so I thought, well, that's what, they drink a lot, so that's what I'm going to do. And I guess looking back, anybody, you know, had I expressed these things out loud to people, they probably would have been, oh, that's a red flag. It's a red flag. And you know, that was just kind of my plan. You know, I'm going to just get as drunk as I possibly can, and I don't care what happens. And I walked in, and I probably drank a couple of beers with my friends, and then went over and started talking to the girl. And she said, let's go take some shots. I said, great. You know, I'm terrified. and we walk over, and we get the big bottle of Crown Royal down. We took 18 shots of whiskey. And she fell over like a board, and I'm like leaning on the wall, you know. But I know that this is not good, you know. I know I just drank a lot, and I really got scared, you know, because I thought, you drank a lot of liquor. You're 16 years old. I weighed about 100 pounds, and so I went in the bathroom. I remember hearing that if you splash cold water on your face, you won't be drunk anymore. We gotta give it a shot, you know, So I tried it, and ends up after 18 shots of whiskey, it doesn't really matter what you do, you're going to be drunk. And, you know, but the next thought I had is what probably separates me from 90%, you know, 90% of the other drinkers out there is that the next thought I had was, well, if you're going to get drunk, you might as well enjoy it. And I walked out of the bathroom and I walked into the kitchen. I grabbed another beer and I don't remember anything else until I woke up the next morning. And I woke up and everything kind of seemed like it was all right. You know, the house was still standing. I mean, she was there. Car was out front, you know, no cops, no, there wasn't anything bad going on. I thought, man, this is great, you know, and I didn't think, you know, I can't wait to do this every day for the rest of my life, but I did think, we got to do this again, and we got to do it as soon as we can, you know. Now, 16 years old, you're not going to be, well, I wasn't drinking every day at 16, that didn't happen until I was 17, but, you know, so my senior year of high school, I'd grown up playing sports, and they started falling by the wayside. I'd gotten pretty good at some of these sports, and you know, it wasn't. I never really thought of it that that I would. God, what do they say? It wasn't like I like drinking became more important than playing sports. It's more like I got drunk and I forgot to go to practice. It was like Tuesday afternoon would come around and there wasn't anything to do for the next 4 hours, so I would start drinking, you know, and I'd maybe just have a couple of beers, but then I figured I would just had a couple already, so why not? I'd just take a couple shots, no one will smell it if it's vodka, right? And and the next thing I know, it's like 7:30, and I thought, oh my God, I got to be at practice in 30 minutes, you know, and I mean, I can't even stand up. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess some people say that it became more important. I just kind of forgot. It's the way that I saw it. Maybe that'll change down the road. I don't know. But, you know, for 16, 17 years old, I would just drink all the time just because it was more fun, whatever we were doing. I mean, if we were going to the movies or if we were going to a hockey game or a basketball game or football game or hockey practice or just going out driving or whatever, I was going to get drunk beforehand because it was always more fun, and it never really seemed to be a problem. You know, so I graduated high school. I was 17 years old, and just like any good teenager from the D.C. area, we all know there's this one liquor store that'll sell to pretty much anybody. If you can drive up and drive away, you're fine. So, 17, I walk into this liquor store for the first time, found a place that would sell to me, and I thought, man, now I'm set. You know, this is it. And I remember so many times coming back in the middle of the week. I would drive from Rockville to College Park, no problem. You know, 30-minute drive was well worth it. You know, if I was able to get, you know, 5 or 6 bottles of whiskey or 5 or 6 bottles of whatever, drive it back home, and, you know, show up to my friend's house, and I walk in with a couple of bottles, and be like, what are you doing? I say, well, what? I mean, we got it. Let's get drunk. And they're like, it's Wednesday. I'm like, yeah, I know, but because we don't usually have it on Wednesdays, that's why we probably didn't get drunk on Wednesdays before, but now we do. And they're like, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, well, what else are you going to do? Like, we got school tomorrow. I'm like, it wasn't adding up, you know? And, you know, so my friends, they just didn't understand. but because I had this basically endless supply of liquor, I started drinking every day just because I could. Just really just to do it, you know, because like I said, everything at that point is just everything was more fun. And, you know, there were never really any consequences for it, for the most part. Maybe a drunk in public or an underage possession, you know, our party gets busted and we all gotta, you know, go to court, you pay your $75, you lie about your community service and you go back to it. Not a big deal. And that's just how it was. That's how I operated. I failed out of community college in the meantime, and I was working in restaurants, and I thought, this, you know, college isn't for everybody, you know. My example at the time was Bill Gates. I said, well, Bill Gates, he never finished college, so, you know, Maybe I could be like that. Clearly, I'm not Bill Gates, you know. you know, I was working in these restaurants, and I'm sure a lot of you know how it goes when you're working in restaurants is, you know, fast money every single day, and usually a lot of it. When I was 19, I started bartending at this one restaurant. They let me pick up a couple bartending shifts, and I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. It was, this was going to be it. I was just going to be a bartender, and, you know, it seemed like such the dream job, you know. Here I'm getting, people are giving me money to get them drunk while I get drunk, you know, and I'm making money doing it. And you're meeting people, you meet the people that are bartending at the other places. And so, you know, you just go later and you get drunk for free. It's great. And I was stealing liquor from them, too, just in case. I had a real elaborate system with my backpack. I would just throw bottles in and run it out to the car real sneakily, if that's a word. The next real goal I had for myself was to be, like, 75 years old, sitting in a rocking chair on a porch somewhere, drinking whiskey out of a mason jar, and watching, like, kids and grandkids run around the yard. And now where any of that stuff comes from, I could not tell you. But I figured I had about 55 years to figure it out. Because that was just the next stop for me was, yeah, I mean, here, I knew what I wanted to do. And at this point, there really hadn't been any type of consequences other than those little citations. And, I really believe that had I gotten into some kind of trouble up to that point, you know, when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, I probably could have just stopped drinking. If I was given a good enough reason, I probably could have just stopped right there, and it never would have been a problem. But that is not my story. When I was 20, I got my first DUI, and my mom got real scared. And my little brother was with me, and I thought, oh, that's probably not real good. But my mom was freaking out. She's crying, and she wants to know, oh, my God, what's happening? And she sat me down the next day. She said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? I said, Mom, please. I said, everybody gets one. And she said, I didn't get one. I said, well, nowadays, everybody gets one. And she was okay with it, you know. And so I went to court for it, paid my lawyer a lot of money, and he called me names like alcoholic. Stuff like that. I thought, what's wrong with you? I'm giving you all this money, and you're calling me names. And, you just, please, just keep me out of jail, and we'll be okay. So, go to court, and they get put on probation for a year, which seemed like just another little slap on the wrist. And what the judge told me was, you're putting you on probation for a year, you got to pee in the cup, you got to, you know, go in, talk to this person every week, and check in with the state, and all this stuff, and go to two AA meetings. And you got to do it for a year. So, well, all right, fine. You know, what I heard was, you've been drinking and driving every day for 3.5 years. You got caught once. Don't get caught for a year. Very different from what he said, right? so I just, nothing changed. Nothing was different. I mean, I left court, met up with friends, went and got drunk that night. And, I just picked some weird times to get drunk. I got drunk. There was one night that stood out to me that I had to be at Motor Vehicles the next day for my hearing to see if I keep my license. And I remembered thinking the night before, probably shouldn't go out. And I thought, oh, whatever, it's just go, have two, come home. I came home at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And what I remember is waking up to my house phone ringing. It was my lawyer calling me, asking me where I am. I'm like, yes, you called me at home. Where do you think I am? And he says, well, why aren't you here? I'm at court. I got it delayed. And I was like, oh, man. You know, so I know, again, not real good, but not such a big consequence that it really mattered much, you know. I said, well, all right, we'll just pay him a little extra money, and he'll get it extended an hour, and I'll get there. And he said, just get here as soon as you can. I said, all right. So I just changed clothes, and I got in the car, and I left. I get there, and he said, looks at me and says, what's wrong with you? He says, you smell like a bar. I said, you told me to come right here, so I didn't shower. And he said, you look like a mess. You look like you just woke up. And I said, yeah, I did. And, just more poor decisions. But, like I said, nothing changed. Nothing was different. And about 6 months after I got my first DUI, I got my second DUI. And it was on a Thursday night. And I had one of my friends with me, about the only friend I had left now. Most of my friends didn't want to hang out with somebody who was getting arrested and getting in trouble. I can't imagine why, but there was one guy, John, that was still. I'd known the kid since I was like 9 or 10, and he was with me when I got my second. And what was amazing is that I got out of jail the next morning, and I was scared. I mean, I was real scared. Like, I knew the driving had become a problem. And I went out with my friends on Friday night and Saturday night, and I watched them all get drunk, and I just drank soda. I probably drank, like, 4 liters of soda each night. You know, like I'm going to get drunk off soda, right? And I drove everybody home, and Sunday night I was working in D.C., so I was taking the Metro back to my car. And this is probably the most important 24 hours of my entire life up to that point. It's about 10 o'clock, I got off the train, and walking to my car, I thought, you didn't drink the last two nights and you didn't get in trouble. You should just go home. And so it's a good idea. You know, so I start driving home. And this night, it just got weirder and weirder as it went on. Never had a night like it in my entire life. But anyway, this guy called me up. He said, I turned 21 at midnight. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like once in a lifetime. You know what I mean? That really is once in a lifetime. So I went and I said, all right, I'll come pick you up and take you out, you know, with a couple of guys. And so we go bar hopping on a Sunday night and ended up, we walk into the first bar, and as soon as we walked in, it was just like any time I'd ever walked into a bar in my entire life. You know, I walk in, and the people around me are drinking, and they're having a good time, and I don't know that I thought that they looked a little more comfortable, you know, than I felt, but, I'm around people that are drinking, they're having a good time, and I guess desire and opportunity cross, and there I go, I start drinking, just like every time I'd walked into a bar. And I started, you know, had a couple there, and then had a couple at the next one, a couple at the next one, and at the last place we were leaving, they called for last call, so they ordered another round of beer, and this girl came up to me with this beer, and she said, there's an extra one, do you want it? And she put it in front of me, and I looked at it, and for the first time ever, I thought, you shouldn't have that. This is a bad idea. You should not drink that. And, I mean, believe me, threw me off. I was like, what? But she put it in front of me. She said, do you want it? And I reached my hand out, and I said, yeah. And I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking it. And the entire time I'm drinking it, I'm thinking, this is not a good idea. This is going to be really bad if you get pulled over. Somehow I had calculated to myself that I'd be over .08 if I got pulled over. I don't know how you do that, but I guess it's an intuitive thought. But, I'm sitting there thinking, this is not good. This is a bad idea. And then it was done, and it was time to get in the car. So we got in the car, we started leaving. And as soon as I pulled out of the parking lot, I'm getting followed by a cop. And, I mean, there's not a whole lot of people on the road at, like, 1:15 in the morning on Sunday night. And he's following me, and I just had this terror in my chest. And I knew that the game was over. And he didn't even turn his lights on. And I started pulling off into this neighborhood, and then he turns his lights on and comes up, asks me some questions, and says my 5 least favorite words, get out of the car, and we start talking outside of the car. And he made me do the little field sobriety test, of which I thought I did pretty well, and he thought I did okay, but said, last thing, just blow in this tube for me. And I blew a .09, which is so lame. It is so, I mean, I've been at frat parties and blown like 0.33 at 11 o'clock, you know? This is like 0.09. This is like how I woke up in the morning. And I couldn't believe it. And he told me I wasn't getting arrested. And I'm standing there with the handcuffs in front. And I'm thinking, well, maybe because my hands are in front of me, I'm not getting arrested. Or maybe I'm not getting arrested because he's letting me sit in the front seat of the police car. And it wasn't until I was handcuffed back to the picnic table that I'd sat at before that I realized I've been arrested. And, it was just, that feeling inside, that just emptiness just started, started eating at me. And I spent the last of the cash that I had on a cab ride back to my mom's house and stood in her backyard. And now it's probably 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning. And I remember standing outside, I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do, because you can't tell your family about number 3 when they don't know about number 2. You know? I don't know who I can talk to. I talked to John, I guess, because he was with me when I got my second. He might understand, but I really don't know what to do, because now I'm screwed now. Like, I've now violated probation twice in 3 days. With the same offense that they charged me with at the beginning, that put me on probation. And, just mulling over all this stuff in my head, and, I stood out there, and I could feel the wind kind of blowing through me. It's the middle of January, so it's cold. And I feel the wind blowing through me, and I thought, man, this is weird. And I went inside and washed my face and put my hands on the sink. I looked in the mirror for the first time in years. I looked at my eyes, and it's just black, just nothing there. I thought, man, again, this is getting very weird. And I went outside to smoke one more cigarette. I guess I got a moment of clarity or a moment of grace or whatever you want to call it. I had, a realization of my life at that point. And here I look. Here you are, 21 years old, drinking half a gallon of whiskey a day. Anybody doing that to their body, I figured probably option one is just drop dead by the time I'm 25. Probably just walking down the street, that didn't seem like a very attractive option. So I thought, the only other thing that I could really think of was to kill myself. And I figured out how I was going to do it. There were guns in the basement. And there were knives upstairs in the kitchen, and I was trying to think of the least selfish way to do it. And figured, which knife between which ribs could have lung in my heart, because there wasn't going to be attempting anything, There wasn't going to be some failed attempt. I judge people that did stuff like that. Thought they were crazy. But, there I am standing there, and not drinking never crossed my mind, because, I knew I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was 21, and faced with, no real friendly direction to go, I've got, these two options. I just threw my hands up, and I said, God, either help me or kill me, because I can't do this anymore. And it's probably the first real honest prayer I'd said since my grandfather died when I was 11. The next thought I had was, all right, well, if you feel this bad tomorrow, then if I feel this bad tomorrow, then I'm going to kill myself. Because I had just this feeling come over me that it was going to be okay. And I don't know why. I mean, there was nothing on the outside pointing to, like, this. Don't worry, there's somehow this can work out. And I went inside. I remember going inside and falling asleep. I didn't pass out. I didn't black out. I remember laying down and pulling the covers up and falling asleep. And it was weird. I got up the next day, and I called John, and I said, hey, man, you remember what happened on Thursday night? This is now Monday morning. He said, yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, I remember. And I said, well, it happened last night, too. And he's like, well, we're going to go to a meeting tonight. I said, oh, God. I said, an AA meeting? said, yeah, we're going to go to an AA meeting. And I said, well, I don't know, man. I'm not like those people. And he said, I know this group of young people. I've been around them before when I was in trouble, but I didn't say anything. I didn't tell you about them because I didn't think you were ready. And I'm like, I didn't think I was ready. I don't even know what you're talking about, you know. You see, because part of my probation was to go to those two AA meetings. And so I had been to two AA meetings. I thought I had seen it. And, I mean, I walked in, and the first meeting I ever went to, you know, I walk in, and it's just there's a table with, you know, some guys look like Billy. And I'm sitting around, and I'm like, no way. You know, this is not for me. And I've come to appreciate those people now. But, you know, at the time, I'm sitting there thinking, what is this? I'm 20 years old. I'm like a third the age of anybody in the room. You know, people are talking about my higher power says this, my God says that. And I thought, they're talking about footballs and parking spaces and doorknobs and bricks in the wall. And I'm like, you guys are crazy. You know, I'm not like, I grew up in a religious house where, you know, I mean, I know what God is. God is this, you know. And, you know, just a way to identify myself out, really. You know, so I knew I wasn't like those people. Well, the next time, I went back 3 weeks later to the same exact meeting to get my slip signed again. And, well, I left the first meeting, I got my slip and I stole a big book and went to the liquor store. And the big book actually sat on my dresser for like the next 4 months, but I mean, I never looked at it, never read it, never opened it, never really even acknowledged it. Probably sat liquor bottles on top of it, honestly. Not out of spite or anything, just because that's where it would have gone. But, you know, I went back to the second meeting, and I was, these people were talking about, this one guy shared that his wife has AIDS and he has cancer and he's getting his foot cut off next week, but at least he's not drinking today. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, I didn't even know what to say, you know. So I got my slip and I went back to the liquor store and, you know, kept on drinking. So when John says, we're going to go to an AA meeting, I'm thinking, geez, really? You know, I mean, part of me is thinking, not another AA meeting. And the other part of me is thinking, you better at least check it out because you're dying. And I knew I was dying. You know, I could see it. My skin was yellow and had the sunken in eyes. And, you know, I'd wake up and my stomach would hurt over on the right side, you know, which is not your stomach. I came to find out later. I just figured it was because I drank my dinner and, you know, didn't really have any food, so I thought my stomach hurt it, and it was actually my liver. But, you know, so that day he picked me up. He said something that really baffled me. He said, can you do me a favor? Can you not drink today? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll pick you up at 8. Don't drink. I said, well, all right. And, you know, because I was just, if you'd asked me how I felt at that moment, I'd have told you I felt hopeless. Having never read anything in the book, I'd have told you I felt hopeless. And, you know, he picked me up and he brought me to this meeting. And even walking up to the meeting, this is what was even strange, is walking up to the meeting, it just looks like there's light pouring out of the window, you know. I mean, it's like, it caught my attention, you know. And walking in, I'm still thinking, not another AA meeting. And the other part of me is still saying, you better at least check it out, because you're dying. And I walked in, and I looked around, and I saw, like, young people in AA. And I thought, that's kind of cool. But what really got my attention was that they had something. And I don't, maybe it was because there were young people there, but it was probably more based on the condition that I was in, you know, having been in a very different state than I was when I had gone to those first two meetings. You know, I knew I was dying. I knew there was something seriously wrong with me. Still didn't think I was an alcoholic, but knew that there was something seriously wrong. And I walked in, and these people had something. There was something in the way they talked, and the way that they laughed with each other, and the way, you know, the way that they just carried themselves. And, I mean, I couldn't explain it. There was something in their eyes, you know. I mean, it's just like what Bill talks about, you know. There was something in Abby's eyes. I was floored when I read that. I thought, man, I thought I was the only one that saw that. But he, you know, we stood in the back, like good newcomers, and they asked if anybody was new, and he raised his hand and said, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic, and standing right next to him, so I raised my hand and said, I'm Jimmy, I'm John's friend. And everybody kind of like gave me the extended stare for a second and then turned back around. I was like, oh God, you know, now you've messed up. And this guy came up. Now, John and I are talking during the meeting, of course. And he told me, he said, you should get a sponsor. My sponsor is this guy. I said, oh, okay, all right. I mean, I'd done, he told me to run across 270 in the morning, I'd have done it. And, you know, so this guy, his sponsor, comes up to me after the meeting and says, he's like, hey, how's it going? So you're John's friend, huh? I said, yeah. He said, why'd you come to an AA meeting? I said, well, I got my third DUI this morning. And that's what he did. He laughed. Oh, my God. He says, yeah, that's awesome. And I thought, a Spanish guy. And I thought, either A, he's not listening, or B, he doesn't speak the language. Because there's nothing awesome about, like, you didn't hear what I just said. And he said, well, do you have a sponsor? I said, well, you know, I was thinking, you know, if John, you sponsor John, right? He said, yeah. I said, well, I was thinking, you know, maybe if you have enough time or, you know, and he's like, nah, I know who you should talk to. And I said, fine, you know, who? He said, talk to this guy, Kevin. I said, okay. Gave me Kevin's number. I called Kevin the next day, and Kevin would come and pick me up for the next couple of days. And, you know, between Kevin and the guys in AA that would become my running buddies, I mean, we'd go to 3, 4, 5 meetings a day, you know, because I really didn't have anything going. I was still working at a bar downtown, so I didn't have anything going on, you know. And I got Kevin as a sponsor on when I had like 3 days sober. I've had the same sponsor for 8 years now. And first thing he told me was, if someone in AA asks you to do something, you should say yes. I said, well, okay. He said, because you don't have anything better to do. And it's true. I mean, I really didn't. Like I said, I was just working at this bar, and, you know, that's, I know there's some people that can do it, and I've met people all across the country that can do it. Not for me. You know, so I guess I was like 9 days sober, and this guy asked me, he said, hey, can you help me mop the floor? It was a Wednesday night. He said, can you help me mop the floor tonight after the meeting? I thought, oh, God, you know, clearly he needs my mopping expertise, you know, since I've never touched a mop in my entire life. And I said, well, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, I said, well, Kevin says, just say yes. Somebody says, I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And so we start mopping the floor after the meeting. And this girl came up to me, and she said, if you do this for a month, you'll have a really hot girlfriend. And I thought, my God, I can't believe you guys waited 9 days to tell me that. And so every Wednesday, I was there mopping that floor for that month. And I'll tell you what, I was saying yes to every other thing I could in AA, too. And, you know, I did that for a month, and, you know, exactly probably 1 month of the day, I was mopping the floor at that meeting again, and this girl walked by. I said, where's my hot girlfriend? And she said, don't worry, she's coming. And I thought, well, but the next thought I had was, all right, well, here you go. You've been going to these meetings, you know, 3, 4, 5 meetings a day, and you've been reading the literature, you've been talking to the sponsor, you've been hanging out with the people in AA, you know, you've been just doing all these things, and you haven't had a drink in a month, which hadn't been the case since I was 16. So that's when I thought, maybe whatever it was that those people had, whatever they had that first night, maybe it could work for me too. Not that it already was, but that maybe it could. You know, and you know, in the same time, I'd been talking to my sponsor, I mean, I could see, as far as the first step goes, powerless over alcohol, no problem. I could see that. My life being unmanageable, I never even heard the word. And I couldn't think far enough, or I didn't think far enough to break the word down, like unmanageable. My sponsor did that, and I said, oh, okay, I think I get it now. He says, no, you don't. I said, okay. And he said, can you leave the state? I said, yeah. He said, okay, I'm going to ask you again. He said, can you leave the state? I said, yeah, but I have to ask permission. And he says, okay, we'll start there. And I said, well, all right. So I started to get, like, what unmanageable meant. You know, and after that month, I started to come to believe that maybe whatever those people had, maybe it would work for me too. And, you know, I was about 6 weeks sober. I went to court for that third DUI. The second one, I don't know how, it got lost somewhere in the D.C. paperwork. I don't know. I don't even ask. but, yeah, I went to court for the third, and I had a bunch of people from AA there with me. And, you know, I'm standing in front of the judge, and it's the same judge that I was in front of 9 months before. And he said, didn't I put you on a year of probation? I said, yes, sir. And he says, so you violated probation, yes, sir. He says, you understand that, you know, second offense DUI carries 60 days. Yeah. He says, violating probation carries a year. I said, yeah. He says, you understand you're probably not going to leave here with your family and friends today. And I said, yeah, I understand. And I mean, hear mom, like, sniffling in the background, and I'm like, my heart is just, like, breaking, you know. And me and my sponsor, we had talked about the third step prior to this, and this is on a Monday morning, and we talked about it on Friday, and all weekend, you know, he said, pretty much anything that happens is God's will. I said, well, that's easy enough, you know. So I went through the weekend, you know, God, what do you want me to do? You want me to watch TV? All right. And, you know, so that is very just out of it. And so Sunday night after our home group meeting, the sponsor came up to me and he said, you know, pretty much anything that happens in court is God's will too. And I said, well, wait a second, because that's a little harder to swallow, you know. that's a little more real. That's got like some consequences to it. And I said, okay, you know, so I'm standing there in this courtroom. And, you know, the judge is like, you know, I see no choice but to send you to 14 months in the Montgomery County Detention Center. And I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my, like, I don't get in trouble. Like, I've gotten these little petty citations, but this is like 14 months. Like, a guy like me does not do well in jail. and he says, but I'm going to suspend a year, a month, and 16 days. And you'll serve 14 days starting. You know, I know you're starting to, you're trying to get your life back in order, and, you know, your friends that are here from your program have said more in their silence than your lawyer has, and in his words. And it's like, wow. He said, so I know you're trying to get your life back in order, so I'll let you serve it on weekends. And I'm like, you know. Looking back now, it seems very fortunate, you know. He gave me 3 years of probation, told me I have to have the blow and go on my car for a year and lose my license for a year and all this stuff. And, you know, I walked out of the courtroom and I called my sponsor. And he said, I can't believe you're not in jail. I said, yeah, well, I'm going. I said, Kevin, this is BS. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, God does not want me to go to jail. He said, how do you know? I said, well, I just know. And he's like, you know. But he said, well, what are you going to do? And I didn't understand really what he meant, you know, because really what he meant was, what I told him was, we're going to go get lunch and go hang out and go to the meeting. What he meant was, now that you know what you got to do to get out of trouble, now that the heat's off, you don't have to do anything to look good for court, you don't have to do any of this stuff anymore, what are you going to do? And, I mean, I did not know that it's, you know, a classic time for people to leave AA now that the trouble's off. I didn't know that. And I really didn't understand the level of the question that he was asking me. And, so I told him we were going to go hang out for the day or whatever. And, I ended up serving my weekends in jail, and we started talking about the fourth step, and he said, why don't you go read it? I said, okay. So I come back, and he said, did you read it? I said, yeah. He said, what'd you think? He said, it was good. And, I read a novel. He says, do you think you should do one? I said, yeah, but I don't know when I'm going to have time to do it. He said, well, how about this weekend? He said, it seems like you'll probably have a lot of time, seeing as you'll be sitting in jail. And I said, well, okay, all right, you can't argue with that. And I started working on my fourth step. I wrote 90% of it sitting in that jail cell. And, my experience with the fourth step, it was that there wasn't anything on there that was new. You know, I knew everything. I knew the people I hated. I known all my secrets, the stuff I was taking to the grave. I knew the things that I was afraid of. All those things I knew. And John, the guy that had brought me around, he knew most of those things too. He probably knew 80% of the stuff on there. So nothing there was like really revealing to me when I wrote it out. When I sat down with him later and went over everything, I did my fifth step, he pointed out some patterns that were like, oh. I mean, but how can you argue it? I wrote it, you know? So it was pretty uncomfortable getting to see those things. And so what I was left with after doing my fifth step was looking at this piece of paper and sitting there for an hour looking at this stuff and being pretty disgusted with what was there. And, knowing that is no way for somebody to be living their life. And, the sixth step and the seventh step, it's in a chapter called Into Action. So I got to figure there's some kind of action to take with six and seven. And the best I can come up with is that the sixth step is, being entirely ready. I've got to act differently. If I'm so disgusted, if I'm truly disgusted with what I saw in the fifth step, then maybe I can act a little differently and try to be a little bit better of a person today than I was yesterday. And in the seventh step is, I say a prayer and I let God do His work on it. I can take some actions, but I can't change myself. And I can't change my defects of character. But I can change the actions that I take and I let God do the rest, because I've got to change. I cannot be that same person. That person that was in that fourth and fifth step, it was pathetic, it was petty, and it was just an uncomfortable situation. So I go through six and seven, and then I wrote, and not that six and seven are like done, It's there's something's always got to change, it seems like. but I wrote out my eighth step, and again, with my eighth step, it wasn't anything surprising, I knew the people that I hurt, it's the people that I did not want to see, some people were unavoidable, like my family, and the people I owed money to, not a problem, I knew that, it was like a handful of people and places, but there's the people that I knew I was going to have to go back and apologize or go back and make right. I knew those people. So that didn't really surprise me either. It was the ninth step. It was the hard part. Making the list is easy. It's making the amends. And continuing with the amends. I made amends to my dad. Well, sort of. I started making amends to my dad when I had about 3 months. I was 3 months sober, and I just finished serving my weekends in jail. And it was my sponsor's birthday, and they had planned a surprise dinner for him for his birthday. My dad wanted to meet the same exact night, and I thought, oh God, what do I do? I can't call Kevin. I can't ask him. Do I miss your surprise birthday dinner? So I called his sponsor, and I said, Arno. I don't know what to do. So here's the situation. He said, well, how are things with your dad? I said, they're not good. He said, what do you mean they're not good? And I said, we haven't talked in 8 years. We really haven't spoken a word in about 5. And he said, you better go meet with your dad, because you may never get this chance again. Kevin will have another birthday next year. I thought, but it's Kevin's birthday, you know? And so I did. I went and I sat down with my dad, and I did the best I could. You know, I sat down with him, and I said, look, I know we haven't had the best relationship over the last few years, and you've probably heard the things that have happened. Over the last 9 months, I've gotten into a lot of trouble. 3 months ago, I started going to AA meetings and got involved with this group of people that, it has helped me to not drink for 3 months. I mean, I didn't know how to explain it to them. I said, so I've been going to these meetings every day. I've been getting involved with these people, and I've been sober for 3 months now. And gave him my 3 month chip, and he told me some stuff about himself. Tried to relate to me as best he could, and gave me a hug, gave me all his phone numbers, key to his house, all that stuff, and gave me a hug, told me he loved me, and we've been good friends since, talked a couple times a week since. But it's something that's got to continue. And he's always kept my whatever my last chip is that I give him. He calls me on like random anniversaries. He calls them like 5.5 years. He called me congratulating me on 66 months, and it's just you gotta love it. No doubt he'll call me next month and congratulate me on 100 months. I would almost bet money on that. But, that relationship is, I mean, from a guy that I hated, and I hated him so much for the longest time that, I told my little brother that it was okay for him to go to his, I'm going to go to my friend's house, you go to your friend's house on Friday afternoon, that way when Dad comes by, neither of us are here. We don't have to go see him because you don't want to have anything to do with him. You know, he's a scumbag. He's not a good guy. And my brother, poor guy's 4 years younger than me, and so parents are getting divorced. He's 9, 10. He's got no idea what's going on. He just knows that Dad's a bad guy. And I've poisoned him with that for a long time. And but the relationship I have with my dad today is pretty incredible. We talk a few times a week, and my goal today is just to be his best friend. That's about that. And the amends with my mom have gone, fine. She doesn't expect anything. She called me up. She's like, "Is there something going on? Is there something you need to tell me about?" After I've been sober a little while, and I said, "Mom, look, here's what's happening. I'm sober, 5 years now. You sleep at night. You don't have to wait for me to come home anymore. We're both living better lives than we ever have." She said, "Well, that's a good point. That's fine." And, one of the best amends, and really just making, just by taking the principles in AA and applying them in my life with at work and with family, and I was able to finish school, and no one was more excited about me graduating college than my mom. She was like the happiest person in College Park that day. And it was so funny. She came, I know undergrad took a little while, 9.5 years. She said, "I know it took a little while, but are you thinking about going back for a master's?" I said, no. And she said, "Well, think about it, But we've been close, and we have, she's very business oriented. She wants to have lunch once a quarter, All right, no problem. with my little brother, has called me at times where he's actually comfortable talking to me. He called me when he was going through a real depressing time when he was at school, and needed somebody to talk to. And we don't have conversations like that. Me and my brother, we talk about girls and cars and stuff. And he needed somebody to talk to. And And I jumped up out of my class, and I ran outside, and I said, "What's going on?" And he just opened up, and I was like, "Oh my God, man!" You know, but we're able to have those types of conversations, and probably one of my favorite things that's happened is one of my cousins. She got married July 4th of 2001. July 4th, 2000. I did not want to go to Dallas for a wedding. I wanted to stay here. I wanted to stay in D.C. And I had a plane ticket and everything. I just never showed up to the airport. Never went to anything. And I was in Houston about a year and a half ago. And she and I were in the car talking, I'm afraid, on our way to one of my other cousin's weddings. And we were talking about, like, broiling crawfish. And she said, "Yeah, it's just like we had at my wedding, remember?" And I was, "Oh, God, you know, the one thing that I always leave the room when my family starts talking about Karen's wedding. I always just get so uncomfortable I have to leave the room." And, we wouldn't, like, run out hysterically. I would just kind of, you know, excuse myself, I gotta go to the bathroom, you know. But here we were sitting in the car, and it's like point blank. And I said, "No. You weren't there, really? I didn't know. So, needless to say, I get on the phone with my sponsor. I'm like, "I got to do something here. This has got to get right." And from taking these principles and applying them with my family, and you know, just trying to help people where I can, I went and made amends to her. I guess it was last summer. You know, I'd been hanging out with her all week, and I never got a chance to, like, you know, just pull her aside for a second and say what I need to say. And all week long, and so now I'm going back to my house, and I'm walking out the door, I'm like, "That I can't, I have to go back and do this." And I open the door, and she's standing right there. I said, "Can I talk to you for a second?" She goes outside, and I said, "Look, when we talked in the car last year, you know, about me not being at your wedding, I just wanted to let you know, you know, that I was, you know, a very sick person. You know, I was just living an uncontrollable life, and I was just not in a good place, you know, when you had your wedding." And she said, "Well," she's like, "Stop, please." She said, "You do not need to apologize for this." I said, "No, I need to make this right, you know, or I might not overcome drinking." And she said, "Please, everything is fine between you and me." She's like, "I see the way you are with my kids. You know, they look up to you like an older brother. I see the way you are with my dad. You're like another son to him." And she's like, "Dad, you couldn't ask for anything more." I was like, "God damn, you know." I said, "Okay, all right." She's like, "I love you. Don't worry. Just stay in touch." I said, "Great." So I gave her a hug and on her way. And those events have gone the same with most of my family. You know, I mean, my grandmother, who I stole money from, you know, I didn't really steal it from her. I'd ask her for it, and she'd give it to me because I knew she wouldn't say no. You know, well, we have lunch every Wednesday, and it's just highlight of my week. Go pick up my 92-year-old grandmother and go have lunch, and, you know, we're going to walk through the cafeteria line. We're going to stop, we're going to look at the board, right? And we're going to read all the options. She's going to read them out loud to me. And then every week we're going to say, "Well, we better just see what it all looks like, you know. We don't even need to stop, because we're just going to make the decision when we see it, but we're going to stop and we're going to read it." And then we're going to walk by all of her friends, you know, and walk all the way around and come back to the table over here that we always sit at. So, you know, far from anything I ever wanted, you know, certainly a long shot from sitting on the front porch in a rocking chair with the mason jar full of whiskey. But, you know, the life I live today is far beyond anything I ever could have imagined. You know, I know a lot of people say that if I'd have written down everything I wanted when I was new, I'd have sold myself short, and you wouldn't even believe how true. I mean, it's so cliche, but it's so true. It just has to be your experience. Same with the fourth step and the eighth step, you know? I mean, fourth step. I wrote my fourth step, and I don't hate anybody anymore. I'm like, what? I wrote my fourth step, and I didn't hate my dad, you know? It's pretty good. I wrote my eighth step, and people are like, "Oh, these people are just going to come out of nowhere. You have to make a mention." That's not possible. People just come out of nowhere. You know, I thought you write your eighth step, and it's like, Now that they're in your mind, you see them walking down the street. They've always been there. You just now see them. And, but I wrote on my itch that both of my grandmothers fell that weekend. You know, they both needed help around the house. This is crazy, you know. So all these things that sound so cliche, you know, you stick around long enough and they become your experience, you understand, you know. And I think I'm probably out of time. Oh, 30 more minutes? No? Oh, okay. But thank you guys for having me. I love coming down here, I guess. And I really like this group a lot. So thank you very much, Billy.